RIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories: the Taliban say they have captured Afghanistan's biggest border crossing with Iran, as Russia says the militant group controls more than two-thirds of the Afghan-Tajik border. Syria says the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog has turned from a technical organization into a political tool by the U.S., the U.K. and France to exert pressure on Damascus. The UN Security Council backs African Union's mediation between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan in a dispute over the operation of a dam on the Blue Nile. Welcome. The Taliban militant group says it has captured Afghanistan's main conduit for trade with Iran. The Taliban said they will try to shortly put back in operation the Islam Qal'a border crossing in Herat province. An Afghan government official said efforts are underway to recapture it. Islam Qal'a is the second key border crossing the Taliban have captured since they launched a sweeping offensive in early May. The militant group says it is now in control of 85% of territory in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Russia says the Taliban currently control more than two-thirds of the border between Afghanistan and Tajikistan. Moscow has urged all sides of the conflict to show restraint. Amin Alami in Kabul says Taliban advances have led to tensions among Afghan politicians, as some are accused of working with the militants.
The Taliban militants say that they are trying to further expand their operations not only in border areas of western Afghanistan but also across many other districts of this key province, I mean Herat, in western part of this country. On the other hand, the rise of Taliban attacks in northeastern Badakhshan province of Afghanistan has also created concerns and even tensions between Afghan politicians here, even in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Many have blamed some top political leaders and even military figures for being or behind secret deals with the Taliban militant group in order to retreat from key districts and areas in Afghanistan in order to help the militant group to expand their territory and control over the Afghan lands. In the meantime, Afghanistan's defense ministry also says that the counterattack operations are underway across Afghanistan against the militant groups, and that over 15 districts have been retaken by Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, known as NDSF.
Syria says the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog has turned into a tool to exert pressure on the country and direct false accusations against it. The actions of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons contradict the principles of impartiality. That's what the chairwoman of the Syrian mission to the OPCW said. Rania Arifai said the U.S. has the largest chemical arsenal in the world, but it is not destroyed despite posing threats to global peace and security. She said Syria joined the Chemical Weapons Convention in 2013 and has fulfilled its obligations ever since. Arifai was addressing an OPCW meeting. The U.S., France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. Well, after a hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Iran, Russia, Turkey have resumed their talks on the Syrian crisis. Negotiations focused on the current situation of Syria. During our news review program, we discussed that issue.
And I welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of today's top stories. Iran, Russia, and Turkey have decided to continue cooperation to decisively defeat Daesh terrorists and other terror groups in Syria. Announcement came in a statement following the 16th round of peace talks on the Syria crisis in Kazakhstan's capital, Nur-Sultan. Three also renewed their commitment to Syria's sovereignty independence, unity, and territorial integrity. Talks started Wednesday with diplomatic delegations coming together for the two-day talks. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, also attended the negotiations, along with a delegation from the Syrian government and its opposing parties. Focus of this round of talks was the situation on the ground in Syria, as well as confidence-building measures, including a prisoner swap. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Paul DeRudy from the Syria Solidarity Movement from Berkeley, California, and Daniel McAdams, Executive Director at Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, joining us from Lake Jackson, Texas. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there with you, Daniel. Nice to have you. Your initial thoughts on this 16th round of talks and what possibly could come from it. Positive.
Well, I think the only positive thing will come when the United States, if the United States finally decides to stop occupying Syrian and Iraqi territory against the wishes of those two governments. You know, you have the U.S. bombing Syria and Iraq on the border, ostensibly bombing U.S. allies, bombing Iraqi militias that are tied to the Iraqi government who were formed for the express purpose of fighting against ISIS. So, in fact, we're fighting and killing the people who are fighting and killing ISIS. So, really, in 2021, the U.S. presence there makes no sense. Yes, the talks are useful, they're helpful, but ultimately, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the United States military illegal occupying soil in Iraq and Syria.
Thank you, Mr. McAdams. And Paul, I'd really like to welcome you to the program. It's kind of peculiar here that Turkey's part of these talks because they're part of an occupying force on Syrian soil right now. But so is the U.S. So, Paul, where do we stand and what needs to be done for Syria to get beyond 11 years of war?
As you say, Turkey is one of the powers that is backing the Daesh and other terrorist groups. And so is the United States. The United States didn't participate in the talks, but the representative was there. So all of this is a bit strange. I think it's possible that Turkey is getting tired of dealing with this and that the terrorists are a burden on them in primarily Idlib province. And also if the border crossing for so-called humanitarian aid is not going to be renewed, some of the support for the terrorists in Idlib is drying up. So I don't know. Maybe Turkey has its own internal problems that it has to deal with, not the least of which is that it's hemorrhaging money by supporting the military and trying to expand Turkey into Syrian territory. So maybe it's time for them to pull back. I don't know. We don't know what happened at the talks there. But if this commitment is there, it means that at least Russia wants this its commitment in Syria not to end, but at least not to drain them of their military resources. So we have to wait and see. But I think it's a positive sign that this is the declaration that came out of this and that everyone is signing on to it, not the United States, of course. But I think that the pressure on the United States is eventually possibly going to make it impossible for them to stay, as it may be connected with the withdrawal in Afghanistan as well. Who knows?
And Daniel, can there be peace in this country without giving this country back its sovereignty? I mean, can there, with the U.S. continuing its presence, with the Ankara having, basically people, soldiers, boots on the ground there, with the U.S. blessing the Kurds with Syrian oil instead of the Syrian government, with Israelis carrying out sporadic attacks on Syrian soil, how can this country ever get back to any resemblance of normality?
Well, I think that's by design, at least on the part of the U.S. and the Turks and the Israelis, who, as you rightly point out, Every time they get a feeling, they just go and drop some bombs on Syria. In fact, Turkey and Russia have had to issue Iran have had to issue a statement saying, "Hey, Israelis, why don't you stop bombing? It's not doing any good." Really, I think, and I hate to be a Pollyanna about this, but I think this problem will, for the most part, be solved when the U.S., if the U.S. withdraws from the region, because the U.S. presence only emboldens the Israelis to act in a way that they wouldn't be able to act without the U.S. there. Certainly the Turks, as my colleague suggested, are getting tired of this albatross around their necks in Idlib province. They've got their own Kurdish problem to deal with, the Kurds, of course, being backed by the U.S., both of which together are stealing Syrian oil. So the short answer is no, they're not going to get back to peace, and the big task of rebuilding with these occupying forces there, with bombs continuing to drop, and with really international law being flouted. It's pretty ironic that the U.S. continuously talks about the rules-based international order when every single day it basically wipes its nose in the rules-based international rules of order. So, you know, until we start practicing what we preach, we can forget the poorest, the long-suffering Syrian and Iraqi people from ever going back to reasonably normal lives.
Good stuff, gentlemen. Thank you both for joining us on the program here. Paul Lurie there from Berkeley, California. Mr. Daniel McAdams joining us out of Lake Jackson, Texas. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Iran's ambassador to the UN says the U.S. sanctions against Tehran are hampering efforts to import medical supplies and devices. Majid Takht-Ravanchi described the U.S. measures as crimes against humanity and war crimes. Iranian ambassador called for the removal of sanctions, adding that the harmful knock-on effects of the U.S. measures affect all people, including women and children. Although the U.S. has exempted imports of humanitarian items from its sanctions regime, broad U.S. measures have constrained Iran's ability to finance such humanitarian imports. Tehran has time and again reiterated that the U.S. pressures run counter to international rules. The UN chief is deeply concerned by Israel's Wednesday demolition of Palestinian property in a Bedouin community in the occupied West Bank. That's according to a spokesman for Antonio Guterres. The spokesman said the UN chief reiterates his call on Israelis to cease demolitions. Stéphane Dujarric said such actions are contrary to international law. They also undermine chances for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He said representatives from the UN and other bodies were unable to provide assistance to the community as Israeli forces denied them access. Dozens of Palestinian Bedouins, that is, became homeless after Israeli forces demolished their tents, claiming they were in a military firing range. Rights groups say Israeli demolitions are part of a long-running campaign to make room for new settlements. Jafar Ramini is a Palestinian writer and political commentator. He says the UN's expression of concern over Israeli crimes is far from enough, and the international body must do more to stop Israel's violation of the UN resolutions.
Israel is in violation of tens of resolutions passed by the UN General Assembly. What did the UN do? Nothing. Israel is in violation of many Security Council resolutions because of the veto of America. What did the UN do? Nothing. Instead of words and condemnations and shaking of the head, they could do one simple thing: apply some sanction on the apartheid regime. Why they sanction Iran at the drop of a hat? Why do they sanction Syria at the drop of a hat? Why do they sanction Venezuela at the drop of a hat? Because America asked them to do so, and they have to obey. I have no time for the UN or for their words of condemnation.
The UN Security Council has backed African Union mediation efforts between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan in a dispute over a dam in Ethiopia. The Council urged the parties to resume talks. It said negotiations should be held under the leadership of the African Union and should recommence with urgency. That came after Egypt and Sudan called on the Security Council to help resolve the dispute. Earlier this week, Ethiopia began filling the reservoir behind its Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam for a second year. Ethiopia says the dam is crucial to its economic development and to provide power, but Egypt views it as a grave threat to its Nile water supplies. Sudan is also concerned about the dam's safety as well as its impact on the country's water stations. And now a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner has been released from an Israeli jail. Ghazanfar Abu Atwan has or was on hunger strike for 65 days to protest his administrative detention. After his release, he was transferred to a hospital in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Atwan says he actually dedicates his victory to the Palestinian nation and all free people around the world. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also reacted to Abu Atwan's release, hailing his fight against the Israeli regime. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas also called Abu Atwan an example of strength and resistance against the Israeli regime. Abu Atwan is 28 years old. He was imprisoned in October of 2020. During his imprisonment, he faced physical assault that deteriorated his health. Abu Atwan is among a large number of Palestinian prisoners who are under administrative detention. That allows Israel to put Palestinians behind bars for an indefinite period of time without charge or trial. Officials in the Australian city of Sydney have urged residents to stay at home to help contain an outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian said they're facing the biggest challenge since the pandemic began. She said restrictions will likely be extended further unless case numbers dramatically drop. On Friday, the southeastern state reported 44 locally transmitted COVID infections. That is the highest daily case count there this year. A two-week lockdown has already been extended into a third week, ending July the 16th. Lockdown limits public gatherings in Sydney to 2 people. Residents are also limited to within 10 kilometers of their home. And that's it with international news.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. If we do not vote because we have complaints, I believe this is not right. This is also an important point. Therefore, I accept the complaints, but do not agree with not participating in the elections because of these complaints. The future government must also take the required steps in this regard. Another point is related to the youth. I think highly of the youth and believe the youth are pioneers in all major issues of the country. Not only are they pioneers concerning the issues, but they also push others forward. The same should happen in the elections. I expect the youth, the dear youth of the country, to encourage people as much as they can go to the ballot boxes to participate in the elections and to be active in this respect, particularly in the case of those who are casting their first vote. In every presidential election, a large portion of the people includes those who are casting their first vote. Their participation in the elections is actually like them celebrating reaching the age of political responsibility. It is actually like a celebration they join for having reached the age of responsibility. The last point I'm going to make at the end of my speech is that I see some want to dishearten the people and cause them to lose hope by making false analysis. We are not surprised at what the enemy does, but inside the country, there are some who say things that make people disheartened and disappointed due to their pessimism and their weak analysis, weak in the real sense of the word. They don't intend to do this, but they are disheartening the people. I say this is wrong. Feeling disheartened and having no hope have no place in our country. Our nation is a strong nation, a determined nation. The foundations of our country are strong. We are a powerful country. In the second phase of the Islamic Revolution statement, I explained, and I have also explained in various speeches, that we are a great nation. We are a powerful country. We have many capabilities, and these capabilities are evident to our enemies as well. Everyone knows this.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Midstream.
Lebanon's economic and financial crisis could rank as one of the three most severe the world has seen since the mid-19th century. The public are accusing Lebanon's authorities of deliberately failing to mount an adequate policy response to the country's worsening economic and financial crisis. Lebanon's descent into what could end up being one of the top three worst crises in 150 years has been stunningly swift. The country's gross domestic product GDP, which measures the total output of goods and services, nosedived from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year, as per the latest Lebanon Economic Monitor released by the World Bank last week. The inaction by Lebanese authorities is not due to lack of knowledge or quality advice, but rather the failure to agree on effective policy initiatives and a political consensus that defends a bankrupt economic system, which, by the way, benefited a few for so long. The crisis has caused a grave social fallout that has pushed more than half of the population below the poverty line. The decimated purchasing power of the Lebanese pound has led to more than 40% of households reporting challenges in accessing food and other basic needs. Meanwhile, the nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the same year. Such dire socioeconomic conditions risk systematic national fallings with regional and potentially global consequences. Propelled by popular desperation and anger, impulsive protests now mark the advent of a longer period of unrest, chaos, and even a social explosion across the country as conditions continue to deteriorate. Lebanon is suffering from poor governance and a gaping lack of public accountability. To date, the country's three overlapping crises, a financial meltdown, the catastrophic Beirut port explosion, and the COVID-19 pandemic, have not been met with an effective government response. On the contrary, years of government corruption and incompetence laid the ground for Lebanon's accelerating collapse. Many observers have become habituated to Lebanon's dysfunction and perpetual sense of crisis, but Lebanon's current predicament marks a real departure from the past. Even in the worst days of the civil war, while lacking a government, Lebanese found informal ways to keep the country somewhat functioning. This time, it's a different Lebanon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Crisis hit Lebanon over the weekend, teetered on the verge of complete chaos driven by the Lebanese pound's dramatic nosedive against the dollar that sent agitated Lebanese to the streets across the country, blocking highways with burning tires in Beirut and other areas, and attacking public utilities to protest the deteriorating economic conditions. Now, this coincided with the breakdown of public services that has left the country in total darkness, and with closed gas stations as a result of severe fuel, gasoline, and diesel shortages that have threatened to bring a complete halt to private generators on which the majority of the Lebanese public and businesses, including hospitals, depend for electricity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the collapsing Lebanese pound, which sank to a record low for the first time in Lebanon's history, trading at almost 18,000 Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar on the black market, coincided with the breakdown of the public services, as we just said, especially electricity, because there is no fuel to power the generators. No securing basic public services by any authority is like basically saying, we want chaos, go ahead and bring about the chaos to the country. Who benefits from all of this in Lebanon right now?
Hi to you, thank you for having me. As we know, everybody knows in Lebanon, and probably, most probably the Europeans, who really were the patronizing of the Lebanese political situation from the 90s with Rafiq Hariri, the martyr of Lebanon. And we know the situation in Lebanon is very miserable, it's going to abyss, and nobody would really have a kind of relief for what's going on. There are some thieves in Lebanon, especially in the political class, with their manager of this partnership between the capitalists, the bank owners, and some of the mafias of the sects in Lebanon, who are leading this country into this abyss. I'm not surprised of this collapse of the Lebanese pound. I'm really anxious about the future of Lebanon after this very critical situation. The situation is not only economic situation, it's a political situation. The Americans and the Europeans, especially the French, now talking about a new mandate for Lebanon because of the political change in the region. Now we have many choices probably. First of all, we have to get rid, to reconstruct Lebanon, to get rid of all these mafias and the bank owners and this system this capitalist or this new liberal system. Would the Americans agree? Of course not. They are not eager to see solutions in Lebanon. They are not eager to see Lebanese are satisfied with their authorities. There are no actual authorities to authorize good things or to lead the state into a safe place. Actually, I'm really hesitant to say that all these people who are the solution in their hand are the thieves of the money of the country.
Dr.
While billions.
This brings us to that worse still. Lebanon was quickly sliding into a political abyss, into a risk of instability, into social unrest. The top leaders even failed to agree on forming a cabinet, a new government, to at least rescue what's left in the country's economy. Can you explain to us the dilemma that led to the state of political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, really, really, people, the Lebanese people, they have unveiled all these ambiguities and the Lebanese situation, and now they know that these people who are leading, or what so-called leaders in Lebanon, are not deserving this place or post or position, because they have stolen all the money of the Lebanese. And that's why I guess the Lebanese have the right to raise their voice and go into demonstration, or saying that we have no confidence, no trust whatsoever in this class. And the problem is that all these people were protected by the Americans and the French, and most of them, they have connections with the American embassy and with the Saudis. Now the Saudis raise their hand and say, well, we don't want Hariri, because they said they really said we have paid a lot of money for some of them. Well, most of them, they counted from Jaja to Hariri and others. Well, not to say about other people, because these people are really leading the situation in Lebanon into this catastrophe. And they, of course, they can't. They can't make or shape or form any new government that would lead to a solution in Lebanon and relieve people.
Well,
because
they are the problem.
Because
they are the problem. How could being,
a man
being shaped otherwise in the media? How is it being shaped in the internal and also the foreign media? It's being shown that there is a dilemma, there is a problem, a bickering problem between the President Aoun and the Premier designate Saad al-Hariri, who by the way has been designated since October 22, 2020. Now there are trading accusations. Each one is just pointing to the other, being of blame. And one wants to form a cabinet of non-partisan specialists to enact reforms and salvage the country from an all-out economic collapse, while the other seemingly wants to secure what is called in the media the Christian rights. What's the main reason for this statement?
The main reason?
If Hariri actually has internal and external support, then what does President Aoun want?
Let's say it frankly. For once and for all, President Aoun came to the presidency in order to reform and make some ameliorations to the system, and he could not, because this mafia in these authorities, in the state, they have prevented and blocked any kind of reformation, because they have taken the money of the country. They have stolen the money of the country. How could they help General Aoun, President Aoun, in order to reform? That's the problem, I guess, because also with the political reasoning that would say General Aoun really stood by the resistance in Lebanon, and he did not do what the French and the Saudis want to do in Syria. All this, they are punishing these people, the environment, the embracive environment of the resistance in Lebanon. And I guess this is a kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. What would they do in the future in order to solve the situation, because their men are really the problem? Would they agree, the French, and they are putting now some sanctions on their man. Would that solve the situation? I really don't know.
One more minute before we end up with this problem. One more minute in this segment, Dr. Saleh, but the pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and the basic items have skyrocketed in prices. Do you think that we are looking at the biggest social and economic catastrophe, actually, in West Asia, or is there still time to salvage something?
Well, we are in turmoil. I guess the Americans want to see this kind of turmoil in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and other places, also in Yemen. They are really putting sanctions in order to these states to collapse.
Seems they are succeeding, though.
They are. I guess the peoples of the West Asian countries, they can rebuild and reconstruct these countries because they are the heritage of the Americans and the French. We have one choice only to get rid of these peoples of between brackets, the Americans and the French and the Saudis. And mm-hmm. without kicking out these people from the decision maker of in Lebanon and in other places in Iraq or in Yemen, the Hadi and his gangs, I guess without that, we can't rebuild mm-hmm. these countries and the region. And we are peoples are trying, resisting all this kind of hegemony from the 20th century till now. Peoples are going in the right track.
Hopefully so. Thank you very much from Beirut, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for being with us to talk about the economic and social collapse in Lebanon. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the Yemeni armed forces announced earlier last week a military operation targeting Saudi forces, where days after the announcement, the Yemeni military media broadcasted scenes from the operation of the Yemeni armed forces targeting this camp of the Saudi coalition with dozens of Qassam 2K drones in the Al-Wadi'a border area. Now, spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Al-Sari'a announced the killing of a number of Saudi officers and the killing of more than 60 fighters in the ranks of the Saudi coalition aggression. In this large-scale military operation, more in this following report.
Clashes intensified during the past week between the Yemeni armed forces and forces loyal to the outgoing President Abdullah Mansour Hadi within the Rahwan district, the second largest district of Ma'rib governorate, which extends from northwest to west. This came in the wake of Hadi's forces violating a tribal truce signed in earlier March 2020 between Sana'a forces and some of the leaders of the Rahwan tribes, which stipulated the commitment of the army and popular committees not to attack the district's areas that had been neutralized from the ongoing confrontations. Under the agreement signed by the Marwan and the Shadawda tribes, the largest of the Rahwan tribes, which held for more than a year before Hadi forces violated it, Sana'a granted the people of the district the right to protect and manage their own security. However, the transformation of a number of areas of Rahwan district into a launching pad for the operations of Hadi forces and the Islah Party militias had little effect on the course of the confrontations on the western and southwestern fronts, where the skirmishes declined in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces were able to make new military progress west of the Khanjar camp, specifically in the Khub and Al-Shaga front of Al-Jawf governorate. The military media center in Sana'a published audio and video documented scenes that showed the army and the popular committees in the area, in addition to showing scores of dead and injured Saudi mercenaries. In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari'a, confirmed that the drone air force was able to carry out a massive military operation targeting a training camp of the Saudi Emirati coalition in the Al-Wadi'a area, with 10 Qassam 2K drones targeting the command center training sites and sectors. Saria pointed out that the operation, which was documented by video and audio, led to the killing of a Saudi officer and 60 members of Saudi mercenaries, including a number of military leaders. According to military sources in Sana'a, the targeted camp is under the supervision of the Central Military Command in the region and enjoys high protection and advanced technological security via American satellites. Syria made it clear that targeting Al-Wadi'a camp was a message to Washington that will be followed by other messages during the upcoming period of fighting to liberate all of Maghreb. Now to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is author and academic Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Anderson. Now, footage of the Yemeni Armed Forces media showed the Yemeni Qasif 2K arriving at the scene inside the Al-Wadi'a military camp, which is a very, very important camp on the border with Yemen, while Saudi soldiers and their mercenaries were fleeing. Whoever was left of them fled for their lives. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces have been targeting Saudi military bases for a long time now. Why was this operation very significant for the Yemeni Armed Forces?
It's another step, really, in the Yemeni forces taking over parts of Najran, moving into area that has been disputed for a long time, but in any case, currently Saudi territory. So there's strong support they have also from some of the people there. So, and the use of the drones that you mentioned, as you said, has been used before against other Saudi military bases.
Well, during the same week, Yemeni army forces launched two missile strikes against the position of Saudi-led militants in Yemen's very strategic central province of Maghreb, which is witnessing right now huge operations. They killed and wounded dozens of those mercenaries. Many reason might be behind the choice to take the time to liberate Maghreb, because it's been over 5 months now that the operation of Maghreb had started. However, if you want to break down the situation in this major city, which is bordering Saudi Arabia, why do you think that the Yemeni armed forces led by the resistance forces of Ansarullah are taking their time to liberate Maghreb?
I don't think it's completely correct to say that they're taking their time. They've actually made a number of statements to say that we're going to, you know, move very quickly, and they wanted to move very quickly. But as you say, it's an extremely heavy battle, and it's the biggest stakes in the north of Yemen, really, because this is the one base that the Hadi so-called government based in Riyadh has. In other words, everything that the Saudis have been doing has been trying to reinforce this one significant base on the ground, and if and when Ansarullah-led forces take Maghreb, that is going to change the complexion in the entire region, basically. And as you say, there's been heavy battle, but there's been a lot of airstrikes on the forces coming in from the west, and the Yemeni revolutionary government is using ballistic missiles also against their targets there. I've read that there's been thousands of casualties there, so I don't think their aim is to slow it down. In fact, they are making some moves in other parts of the country at the same time, but this is really the big battle in the north of Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one very interesting thing happened last week was the breaking of an agreement that happened between the Yemeni armed forces and the biggest tribes of Maghreb, because the mercenaries of Saudi Arabia broke that agreement and started shooting from those specific areas after long talks happened between Ansarullah and these tribes, and they all agreed that they should not fight. Do you think that Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to maneuver something new to maybe bring new enemies for Ansarullah to the table?
Well, there's always the aim to try and divide and carve out sections of the country. I mean, you know, that Hadi himself was the one who was trying to move back to a six-part partition of the country under Saudi direction. So they'll keep doing that, but I think there's a measure of desperation coming from Riyadh now, because they are losing on so many fronts, and the revolutionary government is making incursions into the south now at the same time. So they are fighting on more than one front.
Well, the Swedish foreign minister landed in Riyadh last week, where she met with Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan, and for God knows what reason, she met with Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, the ousted Yemeni president. Now, she tweeted that the discussions were concerning the peace efforts in Yemen for bilateral issues and for humanitarian issues as well, and humanitarian rights. Now, Saudi Arabia is still bombing Yemen,
It's blockading the country, aerial, sea, land blockades, and it's sending even more mercenaries to occupy the country. What peace efforts is she talking about?
Well, the problem is that there is a very bad Security Council resolution, I think it's 2216 from 2015, which frames the whole conflict as though what they call the Houthis are the problem, basically an outside problem, and somehow enshrines Hadi as legitimate president of Yemen. Now, Hadi had an interim role in 2012 through 2014, but somehow this Security Council resolution from 2015 has enshrined forever the role of this exile junta in Riyadh as the legitimate government. And so the language being used, and you see it in the Persian Gulf press and the Western press, the Yemeni government this, the Yemeni government that, they're talking about a regime, or not even a regime, but a group of people in Riyadh, basically, as the Yemeni government. So when other agents, including those looking at the UN security resolution, come in, there's a very difficult structure there to deal with. And what the Ansarullah Revolutionary Government has said, that they'll agree to a ceasefire if the blockade is lifted, unfortunately is undermined by this very bad Security Council resolution from 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Oman has been long perceived as a neutral party in the part of West Asia, and has spent the past few weeks attempting to get Saudi Arabia and Yemen to the negotiating table to find an end to the ongoing suffering of the Yemeni people. Now, the Yemeni conditions for any ceasefire, just like you just mentioned, are fixed. They are not negotiable. Ansarullah said it clearly by the movement's leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He said, lift the siege, halt all forms of aggression, just stop bombing the same place hundreds of times, and end the occupation. I think that these are reasonable. Even if I want to stand by the Yemenis, if I want to look, I want to take a different position and be objective about it, they seem very logical conditions there. What is the next move for Yemen in the event that Mohammed bin Salman just chooses to move forward with the aggression instead of accepting the reality and just giving up on his psychopathic warmongering policies?
It's very difficult. He's in a very difficult situation. Let's say the Saudi rulers are in a very difficult situation because they are losing on several fronts. They're having their own territory incursions into what they consider their own territory, as well as about to lose Marib, which is going to be a very big blow to them. And of course, the Emirates and Israel are in the south, and there's some some movement going on there, let's say, in favor of the revolutionary government. So the Saudis have been suing for peace for some time because they know that they're losing, but they're hanging on to those shreds of so-called legitimacy that the UN gives them and that their Western backers are hanging on to, really. So, but nevertheless, the Saudis know that they're losing. They've gone to Iran, they've gone to Oman, they're doing talks, they're looking for peace. And in the meantime, as you say, the revolutionary government has put a very reasonable position. And while that's not met, they are simply going ahead with what they're going ahead with, and they're making more progress, basically. And this is, the problem is the legitimacy battle going on internationally is going to try and sheet home responsibility to their favoured party. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the international debate.
Well, it seems that we are looking ahead to very decisive weeks ahead in liberating Ma'rib and see where things go for the action negotiations to move forward. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author and academic, for joining us from Sydney to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality, brought to you by the one and only IRB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the pleasure and honor of hosting two wonderful guests. To my left is
Muzaffar Haider from the UK.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you for joining us. And to the right of the ring,
Hassanain from India. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much, you guys, for being with us. I'm Zainab. We are going to be talking about something that I was really passionate to bring up. What do you think is the best job and lifestyle for introverts and extroverts? Brother Hassanain, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
No, it depends on upon the like different situations.
No, generally yourself. I mean, obviously not.
Okay, I consider myself as an extrovert.
Yeah,
I consider
you're
you as an
extrovert
too.
I could tell.
Brother Lafar.
I don't know. I really.
You
don't
are
know.
Definitely an extrovert.
No, I'm not.
No, you're a tired extrovert, is what you are.
That's it. I'm a tired extrovert. I am so tired of being extroverted. I'm an introvert.
Yeah, and then you're slowly, as you get closer to, as 30 dawns upon you, you are slowly but surely.
I'm retreating into my shell. Yeah.
Crawling your way into the introvert line.
Yeah, I'm starting to sound like you, actually, sister. I'm starting to say things like, I hate people.
I would rather not interact with them. No.
That's what all extroverts think about the introverts. Like, they hate people.
We don't hate people, right? I personally suffer from acute general social anxiety.
Self-diagnosed.
No, it's actually not. I was on medication and everything. And it comes to a surprise to everyone.
Self-prescribed?
It comes as a surprise to people because they think I come across as cheerful and bubbly and sociable when I'm doing a show. But then, ladies and gentlemen, for the record, let me clarify officially, it's called Acting. Jazz Hands. It's a show, for God's sake. It's called a show. The name is there. You put on a show.
Yeah.
This is not how I really am because I'm socially awkward. But anyway, I feel that this is one of the best jobs an introvert can have because it's kind of like being online. You know, introverts are very extroverted when they're online.
That's really surprising, sister, because I would have thought that your job, you know, being a radio host, is very much an extroverted job.
But I don't meet any people.
You know,
I used to think,
you think of
a similar way,
yeah. Yeah, a TV presenter or, I don't know, any kind of media personality. It's about people.
Yeah, it's about performing for the people, but you don't deal or engage or meet the people. They see you from behind their TV screen or from their radios. They listen to you, but there's no direct interaction.
Okay, what I've seen that, like, when it was a solo show, like, you're just sitting and talking with the mic.
Yeah, it's like my comfort zone. It's literally my safe place. But just for the record and for argument's sake, let's define. This is one of my favorite things to do. Let's define introvert and extrovert. What do you think introvert and extrovert is, Brother Hassan? No, like, don't you dare.
Introverts, like, I guess, you know, people, they love, you know, living alone. Like, they don't like mingling up with the people.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's it. An extrovert, like, you know, they can, you know, mingle with anyone they find, any stranger. They find a guy, hey, what's up? And they start their, like, conversing with
As them. An introvert, I have to say that even the definition of extroverts give me anxiety. Do you think it's just about being able to interact with other human beings?
Yeah, I guess it's introvert and extrovert is mostly about the engagement,
mm-hmm.
like with different people.
Right. Okay, my internet isn't budging. What's the definition for introvert and extrovert?
So extrovert is an outgoing, socially confident person.
Oh, I have the social confidence of a moldy potato.
Oh, come on.
I really do. No.
So you see, you're an extrovert now.
Look, let me tell you the truth, sister.
Oh, what's an introvert? What's the definition?
Introvert is a shy, reticent person. Look, let me tell you the truth. It's all about acting.
It is.
Nobody in the public eye is ever not acting.
Duh.
If I was not acting in front of people, You would be terrified of me.
We wouldn't sit in the same room with you.
You would just be like, stay away from him. Mm. Everybody is, to an extent, acting. That sounds really, really like...
No, but it's natural.
So then, I was right at the beginning, like, it depends upon different situations, right?
Yeah, no, my point was that Sister considers herself as introverted.
But extrovert, see, there's the key element, all right? Let me just slide this in. The key element is that extroverts enjoy the company of other people, right? If you don't enjoy it, you're acting, you're not actually an extrovert. You're just, you know, you're forced to live the lifestyle that you don't enjoy. And an introvert actively enjoys the company of themselves over all other people. And they have a selective number of individuals with whom they enjoy mingling. That the number is very limited. Again, very limited, but they're still out there. So that's, I think, the key factor in being an extrovert and being an introvert. Okay. Introverts just enjoy their own company more. Yeah. Extroverts, on the other hand, get bored if they're alone.
Okay, Lan, what do you say? Like I might be... introvert for you, I might be extrovert for him.
No. See, that's another difference. Just because you enjoy other people's company as an extrovert doesn't mean that you don't hate some people. Some people are still annoying to you. Some people still irk you. Some people still get on your nerves. It's natural. But in general, you'd rather be with someone than be with yourself all alone. But as an introvert, I can pull hand on my heart, say that there isn't a time in the day where I don't feel like, okay, I want to go home.
No, I think I'm an introvert. If that's how you're defining it, then I'm definitely an introvert. I don't want people at all. I just want to be on my own.
I want to be on my own.
And I'm not getting any time on my own.
Yeah, because you're a father now.
Yes.
So for the rest of your life, you will never have time on your own ever again.
Ever. Right, yeah, exactly. So I think a human being will try and figure out a way to be on their own even while being with people. So then you can kind of... You'll be with people, but you're kind of retreating in your mind.
Exactly. Like, if I'm in a social gathering, I'm usually quiet. I crack a joke here or there, but usually they're very sarcastic snides. My head is always either in my cell phone or in my book. I usually get comments and jabs about it, that, Zainab, you're not engaging with us, and this and that. And I either pretend not to hear it at all. You know what I mean? Yeah. So now that we've established that extroverts... like to be with other, like they enjoy socializing, while introverts, okay, I'm just saying this as an introvert, I'm no expert, and introverts enjoy being alone. What do you think is the best career line? Okay, lifestyle is up to you. You do you, boo, it's none of my business. But what was the best career line for them? We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
You, Brother Muzaffar, as an ex-extrovert now leaning toward introverticy.
Introverts should have office jobs. They should be in a little box.
Cubicle.
The corporate cubicle jobs.
And they should just be in front of their desk. They only have to interact with somebody when their boss comes and says, have you met the deadline? You say yes or no.
What about that report I asked for?
Can you email me? And I'll answer you.
Exactly.
You
know, don't talk to me.
Introverts, right?
We can never hold eye contact, by
desk
the way,
job.
Either.
You know, you're happy. You're just right there. You put a little picture of your grandmother on the right. I don't know.
Or a
cat.
Dog.
Yeah, introverts
or a cat,
are cats
introvert
people. Cat people.
Cat
right?
people.
Yeah, because... But yeah, not a media job. Media is for extroverted people. It's full of people. Hey, you, what's up? Wow, you know, that kind of person. If you're acting, you're gonna self-destruct eventually. You're just gonna be like, I don't want to do this job. Uh-huh. Eventually, right? You're just gonna blow up.
You don't know.
Look, I think acting becomes a part of you eventually, and then you, ta-da, you're interacting with people. Because I think.